Broadcasting live from Studio 1A in Brooklyn, New York. This is Empire State Reptiles Live, specializing in connecting breeders and fans worldwide. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Empire State Reptiles Live. I am so glad to be back here and chatting with everybody on the little chat screen at the bottom of your player. And it's just so great to have another show this week. Next week, there will not be a show. I am embarking on a special trip that I will be documenting over the next week or so on our Instagram page. So you can check us out there if you're interested in that trip. But next week, we will not have a show. But the following week, we will definitely be right here, back here on time at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we'll be ready to start the show and everything like that. All right, so today we have a very special guest on the show, Justin. He works with ball pythons and I believe boa constrictors and possibly some other type of snakes, but he's going to give you more insight on what he works with. You're probably familiar with him working with the emoji ball python, a ball python that he created a little while back, and it's just extraordinary. So I'm going to get him on the show and we're going to talk to him. Good evening, Justin. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Chris?
It's going good, going good. So, mind just jumping in and telling us what you work with?
Well, primarily it is ball pythons. That's kind of what I do full-time now for about 8 years. But I work with, you know, being a reptile lover, I work with a lot of different other species, more as a labor of love. They don't pay the bills the same way. Mm-hmm. But I just love too many different things to just work with one species. So I have some short tails that I breed for fun, some retics that, you know, I'm doing just a couple clutches a year just for my own interest. Kind of the thing I'm really excited about right now is getting into some of the leaf-tailed geckos. And, like, I already have several pairs of Fantasticus that I'm just loving right now. And it's kind of reignited my love of reptiles that aren't snakes. So, yeah, it's pretty great.
Of course. Of course, of course. And ladies and gentlemen, I just almost forgot to mention that tonight's show is sponsored by the beautiful people over at KingDubiaRoaches.com. Last week, they provided us with 500 Dubia roaches for free, and Casey Zoo won that last week, so I would like to thank them once again for that and thank them for sponsoring tonight's show. You can check them out online at www.kingdubier.com. So, Justin, you said you work a little bit, with ball pythons. So what type of morphs are you working with? And I know that you basically almost created a morph for something similar to that.
Right. Yeah, I work on very much every major mutation at this point. Pretty much everything that's really high end or hot in the ball python world, I'm working with. And I have discovered a few mutations myself in my own collection as well, either being imported from Africa, coming out. You know, at this point, most of the new mutations that are in Africa have been discovered at this point. We're not bringing them in every year anymore. But we're doing so much captive breeding going on here in the United States, and we're putting weird animals with weird animals and this and that. I think most really cool new things will pop up in private collections from here on out.
Yeah, that's definitely something that is true. Have you been working with scaleless ball pythons? I know some people like them, some people don't. A lot of people have different opinions on them. So have you jumped into that water or?
A little bit. I do have a male scaleless head, right, or head scaleless, if you want to call it, I guess. You know, the heterozygous form of the scaleless ball python, just missing a few scales on the head. So I have one of those, and I might do one clutch of those this year, but really, honestly, I'm not really passionate about the scaleless head. I guess I'm I wouldn't say I'm on the side of the fence of people who dislike them, but to me, it's just a little bit of a bridge too far when it comes to mutations. I think that although I won't disparage anybody who is working with them, I just don't think that I want to make my ball python scaleless. Really, I don't mind changing the color and stuff, but I kind of want them to have all their parts. That's the personal opinion, but I might make one clutch of scaleless heads this year, and I might eventually make one, but it's not my goal to make a bunch of scaleless snakes.
So working with scaleless snakes, do you see anything that varies with your scaled pythons, like different feeding habits or different ability to thrive different temperatures?
I don't have a full scaleless ball python yet. You know, right now there's only a couple people who do. And they've had kind of a hit and miss record with them so far. But I've been able to, you know, hold several scaleless ball pythons in my hands and kind of mess with them and talk to people who do have them. And I would say, yeah, they are a little different. You know, they move differently. One of the most amazing things to me about them is that because they lack those scales to kind of grab into the substrate or whatever when they're moving, they actually compensate by moving their body in a weird, like kind of bracing it against things in an odd way that looks odd to a person who knows what they should look like when they move.
Of course.
But what's amazing to me is they seem to that. Like, it comes natural to them to move that way when they don't have scales. Like, it seems weird, you know, because you think they'd be very adapted for scales, and they would, like, maybe would not know what to do if they didn't have them. But they seem to still get along just fine. They seem to eat great. They seem to thrive so far under good care. But we're still kind of early in the process a little bit, and I think in 5 years we'll know a lot more about their viability and what kind of issues that will come, you know, come forward long term with them.
Yeah, of course. Now, there's always that one morph or color in each and every hobby that you dabble into in the reptile community that everybody wants. And with ball pythons, what my perception is, or what I basically want, is a pied. So I know a lot of people see a pied and they're beautiful. So what are you working with on that spectrum with the pieds?
So I love the pieds. They're one of my main things. When I first got into it, pieds was the actual snake that pushed me over the line to getting into ball python morphs. Back then, they were about $10,000 each, approximately. Just ridiculously expensive. I mean, even that was cheap compared to what they had been, though. But because I got in so early, about almost 12, 13 years ago, my first pied, I've been able to really push the envelope on that. And right now, the hot thing in pieds is Orange Dream and Super Orange Dream pie ball combos. And last year, I was the first person to make Super Orange Dream pies, which for your listeners, they just need to look one up. They're the best thing about a pie, right? So you have a pie pattern, which is, of course, amazing. But then those saddles, instead of being kind of a reddish brown that, you know, or orangey brown, they are bright, intense orange, just amazing. Just the cleanest orange you can imagine. So that's what we've kind of been working on, is taking the best parts of a pied, which is the pattern and the color, and bringing that color to just the purest possible form it can be. And so it just pops. And the other thing is making it look good into adulthood is a big part, because pieds lose all that color that they have as babies when they get to be adults. But by putting all these different genes in there, we're able to make adults that look basically about as good as a baby does, which is huge.
Yeah, of course. So now especially when I go to reptile expos, you're seeing more pies being readily available and for cheaper prices. Like, you have some pied or pies for $200, $300. So why is that? Is it that more people are producing pies, or?
Oh yeah. So it used to be the pies were the snake to get in order to, you know, as an investment, or, you know, the hot animal to get. Now they are still very popular, but they're also fairly common, and there's no longer a perception of their investment animals the same way. So So therefore, prices have become much more reasonable, and you've been seeing them pop up in Petco's and some places like that now.
Yes, that's smart.
Yeah, which I think is cool, actually, because I think the Pied is so, like, just like it got me into the ball python hobby, I think the Pied will be the animal, the morph that will get a lot of hobbyists that still shop at Petco or PetSmart, will get them into looking at the hobby more seriously and realizing there's a whole world out there they don't know about yet. So,
I think
on the market, like $200 is 200 or so is what they cost now for a regular Pied. And that's pretty low cost of entry for hobbyists, which is great.
Of course. So, what is the dream snake that you don't yet have, but, you're striving to either produce or obtain?
Well, ball python wise, I'm trying to make a clown lavender piebald, so a clown dreamsicle, which
Ooh.
Has not been done yet, but it's just a triple recessive. And because ball pythons lay small clutches and they have a long time to give up the size and all that, we're talking about, I've been about 5 or 6 years into it now, and I haven't made one yet. I might miss for a couple more years before I do, but that's kind of the snake I'm working on, dreaming about right now. But then also species wise, I'm actually getting into a new species, in the next few months. And that is Cape file snakes. I don't know if you're familiar with them. I was actually just in South Africa last month and I was checking them out.
Okay. You said, Cape. I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Cape file snakes. Cape of South Africa, and then file snakes. They're amazing. They're like a snake that has sharp scales on them, and they're just amazing. And they're like a colubrid, basically, body type, and they're non-venomous. Really, actually, fairly easy to keep. And I'm going to be importing a few of them, captive bred, and actually going to maybe hopefully offer a few here in the U.S. They're an amazing animal, amazing snake.
Yeah, so are you planning on trying to develop some new morphs? I mean, I've just looked them up, and they seem to be around, like, grayish, dark gray,
right.
Black.
Well, so far there's no morphs of them, and I don't know that there will be, something will eventually be brought in. But I think just most people have never even seen them, especially not seen them in person. And when you hold them in your hands, they're one of those, oh, wow, animals. Like, this is crazy. Because their skin feels like a cheese grater. It feels like it's going to cut you. It's that crazy. And they have good little personalities. And they're just so kind of alien to the world of snakes, the way they feel, that I'm looking forward to hopefully, captive breeding them successfully and introducing them to some more people here in the United States.
Yeah, of course. So since you kind of segued into different species, I know you work with the boa constrictors also, and those are definitely much larger of a snake than the boa pythons are. So tell us a little bit about that. Boa constrictors aren't really a first starter snake, so a lot of people don't know much about boa constrictors. So
Well, I'm not an expert on them either. I've not worked with them much, but I have kept them for many, many years, more on a hobbyist level, and I think they're pretty cool. But you're right, they're not as good a starter snake. A little bit harder, but it was one of my first snakes was a boa constrictor, and I did pretty well with it.
Of course. So are you planning on? Hello, did we lose you?
No, I'm here. I hear you.
Oh, okay. So are you planning on doing any type of specialty breeding with the boa constrictors, or?
I do eventually, probably. I'll probably kind of back my way into it and just want to dabble in it a little bit. But so far, I've been enjoying them without actually breeding them.
Okay. So I know this subject was definitely going to come up eventually. So, what you're basically famous for is your emoji boa python, which you appeared on several newscasts because of that snake. So, it's just extraordinary, and I'm confused myself on how you produced it. So, how did you go about it?
Well, okay, so it was widely misreported. That was it was my first time ever really kind of going viral in that in the sense. And it was quite a whirlwind, but you really realize how much the news can get these stories wrong. And most of us know, we're in the snake world, the snake hobby, that when you read a news story about a snake, they almost always have several major details wrong. That or they'll, you know, be about a Burmese python, and they'll include a picture of a ball python or, you know, stuff that we just roll our eyes. But this was no exception. So basically, the story is it's a dreamsicle, essentially, which is a lavender albino piebald. And piebalds in general sometimes will have, like, little smiley faces in their pattern. I would say, it's hard to say, between 1 and 10 and 1 and 20, maybe we'll have a perfect kind of little smiley face in one of the saddles on the pied. And that, most people in the hobby are pretty familiar with that, and it's not a huge deal to us. But in this case, I happened to hatch a dreamsicle, which is, you know, way, since it's double recessive, it's way harder to make. And it had not one, but not two, but three perfect smiley faces on it, which is extremely unusual. If you count, you know, 1 in 20 to get one, and then it'd be, you know, it'd be 20 to the third power, and then it'd be, on top of that, it was a dreamsicle, which is, you know, 16 times harder to make than a regular pied. So it's just a really unusual snake. And I initially posted a photo of it. I thought it was cool, but I also, I mean, I'm a little jaded. I've seen plenty of smiley faces on snakes. So I posted a picture of it and on my Facebook page, and people were getting pretty excited about it, but a lot of people were saying it was fake, that I had photoshopped it or just, you know, copy-pasted one of the smileys to a couple more places or something. Right. So if there hadn't been for those people, though, I never, ever would have taken a video of it, probably. I probably just would have sold it to somebody who thought it was cool. But I'm like, well, I'm going to prove these haters wrong if they don't believe it. I'm going to do a little video. So I took a 10-second clip, just without any audio, just a quick, you know, it was a blip in my morning. I didn't even think about it. And I posted it on the same page, just so people could see that it was real. And like a week later, it had over 1 million views, which is obscene for, you know, for what I, for my channel. And that, those kind of views were just completely unprecedented. It kind of gotten outside of the ball python community, or the reptile community, and just people were sharing it all over Facebook. Hey, look at this crazy snake. Look at this crazy snake. And then it died down a little bit. And about 4 months later, I get contacted by Unilad and the Lad Bible, which are two big, you know, Facebook aggregate video sharers, basically. They're just there to share content and get eyeballs for their own companies. Asked me if they could run it. And I said, sure, yeah, at that point. I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, more people can see it, that's the better. Between them, they got 6 million views in about 48 hours. And after that, it was on after that. Everybody, I was getting about 10 to 15 media requests per day at that point to share the video. And the video was on the Today Show. It was on every Fox and CBS affiliate in the major cities in America. I estimate about 30 million views total, approximately. We had film crews come out from Japan and from Brazil and Germany come out and do little shows about it. Like in Japan, they had this thing called Is It Real? And they brought in a film crew and they filmed the snake and they, you know, showed it. And then they went back and they did a show where they had their audience vote on viral videos. And, you know, are they real?
Oh, okay.
And they'd vote and then they'd, you know, turn the camera over to what they had filmed at my place, and that, hey, it is in fact real. And it was just crazy. The whole thing was really crazy and kind of out of body experience to have it go so far so quickly. Then now it's died down again, and everybody's gone back to their corners. But I guess the big thing is it was majorly misreported. Everybody was saying that I had meant to put smiley faces on there. I've been working for many years to put smiley faces on there, which I had no control over that whatsoever. And I couldn't do it again if I wanted to. And they were saying it took them 8 years to put a smiley face on this ball python. And as if I was like trolling it somehow. But
yeah, of course.
But hey, That's the story. Yeah.
Yeah, when I first heard about it, I don't remember what article I was reading, but I was under the impression that you had so many trial and error snakes, and you were trying so hard to get this emoji ball python. I was thinking to myself, well, if he's trying for all these years, I mean, emojis really just have become popular, so that didn't really make sense to me. So that's what I was kind of confused
about. I
would
have really foreseen a trend if I had done that. Yeah.
yes, definitely. So. I'm pretty sure you're not, but are you planning on selling the emoji ball python since you were already going to do it before?
Yes, actually, a newsflash is that as of last night, it is officially sold. I still have it for a little bit longer, but we have a commitment to buy it. And it did go for a little bit, I'd say a fair amount above retail. And
okay.
Going to somebody who really, really going to appreciate it.
Congratulations to them.
Yeah.
Congrats. So how many snakes do you have currently? How many are you housing?
So I have about 400 to 500 probably of my own stock animals, which is quite a big collection. But then that's kind of what I have all year round. But then when the babies start hatching, that's what really bumps those numbers up. Last year, I hatched almost 1,800 babies, which was a lot, even for me. That's a lot more than I probably will ever again. But that's a big jump in mouths to feed.
Yes. So you're talking about mouths to feed, and I know that you run basically your own rat breeding operation solely for your stock animals.
Right.
So how are you able to maintain and all these rats and of different sizes, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
How are you able to maintain it? I know you have your own rat breeding building.
Right. Yeah, I just built a brand new state-of-the-art building for them. If there's one thing that's going to make or break a person who's doing snakes as a business is consistent rodents. I've seen so many people who are trying to do it on a high level, but they're dependent on a rodent producer, and if that rodent producer should disappear or run into some bad luck or something goes wrong, then it can take down a big collection fast. So for me, it's about being self-reliant in that sense. It's an important step. So I just built a brand new facility for the rats. Just really did it up state of the art, the best possible way. It's working out really, really well. I mean, it's amazing to get fantastic, consistent rodents feed every snake. And that's a big part of the equation.
Of course. So now there's much of a debate between the live feeding and the frozen thawed feeding.
Right.
So what do you, since you have so many different animals that you house at once, what do you do? Do you live feed? Do you frozen
and
thaw,
I do live feed, and I can say, you know, I have a bigger perspective on it than most people who are in the debate, because most people who are debating about it usually have a handful of snakes they feed once a week, and you know they just see it as a small sample size. But I did feed frozen thawed for a couple of years when I first started, but for the last 12 or so years, I've fed off, you know, a minimum of 500 rats or mice per week live. And in all that time, you know, I think that's per week. I wouldn't even know how to add those numbers up in my head, but we're talking at least 50,000 feedings, 50,000 rodents, or maybe even double that. And I've never, ever had the kind of result that you see in the horror stories on the internet. You see the half-eaten snake, and you know what I'm saying? It really comes down, I think, to an owner issue more than anything. That's where I come down, live versus frozen thawed. I think if people are afraid that they will not properly care for their rodents, because usually it's the terrible situation is if you put a desperate, hungry, thirsty, unhealthy rodent in with a snake and then leave it there. That's the situation that's going to give you a terrible result. So if you can manage that, those aspects, you should never, ever run into real problems. And the snakes are built to eat live prey. They're literally built to. There's nothing a healthy rat can do to a healthy snake that's going to cause an issue.
That is so true, man. And I know people will probably get mad at me for saying it, but I prefer feeding live more than I prefer feeding frozen thaw, because there's always the possibility that a snake won't take frozen thaw, but it's minimal.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't get them to eat the live, so it's very little possibility that they won't take the live. So hey, why take the risk? Yeah. Anyways. So how are you able to maintain your rats? So if you're somebody who's listening right now and wants to start their own rat collection, even if it's not on the massive scale that you have, how are you able to maintain all of them? I'm pretty sure it's more than just feeding once a week, like the snakes.
Maintaining the rats is the number one X factor when it comes to rats is ventilation, by far. And that's most people who are trying to do it on a small scale. They'll be doing it in a garage type space, or hopefully they're not doing it in their house because there's just no good way to ventilate in the house. But if you're doing it in a garage or an outbuilding, something like that, good attic fans, that sort of thing, to really suck the air, exchange the air in the room. In the new building that I just built, I put massive fans in it, and literally the air is exchanged every 15 seconds in that room. And completely new fresh air from the outside. And that cuts down on any kind of smell, any kind of issue like that. Plus, it also really helps with the heat and air, kind of heat issue, because rats easily will overheat if it gets hot. But if you're exchanging that air, bringing in a breeze, it makes a massive difference. So I'd say that's the number one thing, that and good caging. But good caging is, there's a lot of different ways to do that well, but escape-proofing something really well is a big factor too.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Okay. In regards to feeding, what do you recommend? Is it something like gut loading, or how do you go about feeding?
I feed them a high quality rodent diet. For me, I use a product called Missouri, which Missouri 6F is the brand, the actual type. And that's just made for lab rodents, especially formulated for rodents. There's also other companies like Harlan and other places. You could even do a pig type feed is probably the most similar feed that's not actually for rodents. Pig feed works pretty well. So feed's fairly important, but there's not really a gut loading type situation. It's more about just having a healthy rodent with a healthy level of fat that is a good weight growth.
Okay. Now let me ask you something. Do you ever see one rat in the rack? I'm pretty sure you have a rack system for the rodents. Do you ever see one little rat that just catches your eye sometimes? I mean, I used to have the rats sometimes, even down to the dubia roaches. Sometimes I see a dubia roach that, I just have a special connection with, and I decide not to feed it to. So it might seem weird to some people, but do you ever see a little rat?
Well, I think more people are like that than aren't. I don't... I would say that I do save rats from being fed, but usually because there's something a little different or special about them. If I get one that's a little bit different color, interesting pattern, I'll make that one a breeder. And that one, I always try to get a variety of different colors and different things, because it's kind of makes a little bit of fun to the rodent producing for me. So usually it's not necessarily a personality thing, but if a rat looks a little different, Dumbo ears and is a blue with a cool collar on or whatever, then yeah, they get saved.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So moving on into your the species that you brought up and earlier in the broadcast, the satanic leaf geckos, or just leaf geckos.
Yeah.
I know they're quite expensive sometimes. So what are your plans on those?
Well, I do want to breed them. They're not super easy to produce, but that's part of the fun for me because I'm not trying to make it necessarily a source of income, but it's just something that I want to mess around with. I'm actually feeding them the Dubia roaches, and they do really well on them. Roaches are just, I think Dubias versus crickets is, you know, something that people, you know, obviously debate a lot probably, but I think the Dubias are just so much more hardy as far as keeping them for longer periods of time before you have to feed them. That's the number one thing. And it seems like the animals love them too. It's pretty great. I mean, I would say the only downside to the roaches is that they, at least the Dubias, they tend to hide more, where the crickets are kind of running all over the place like idiots, you know, and making themselves easy to catch. You know, that's the only downside to the Dubias. But I think that's way really far outweighed by the fact that they can just keep them alive for, you know, 6 months or a year, no problem, where the roaches, the crickets will just die off just left and right if you don't feed them off fairly quick.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, the crickets have some weird smell. I'm still trying to figure out where it comes from, but little small specimens making that much scent is just astounding to me. They need to teach me their ways or whatever. It makes no sense. But
Right. Plus, they chirp all the time, too, if you get too big.
Yeah, annoying. Yeah, it's like your house is a rainforest or some type of forest at night. You have crickets. And then they get out, but that's a different story.
Yeah.
So jumping into husbandry, a lot of people like to jump into the ball pythons with the simple care and simple caging. So what do you recommend? I know most breeders have racks for the snakes, of course, as well as the geckos, but
I think racks are great. If you're not trying to do it on the super cheap, I think racks are the best option. But you can, if you are trying to do it, and there's some great rack people out there, you know, who make racking systems that are fairly inexpensive. And one of them I like to always plug is Tallgrass Reptiles. They make this this really awesome little rack system that you can just add one level at a time. As you buy a snake, you can add one level. It's super easy, and it, you know, gives you a good little system. You don't have to buy, you know, a rack of six slots or five slots just to start. But I think you can pretty easily replicate the good aspects of a rack with just using a Sterilite kind of tub or something system with an undertank heater, and you can kind of replicate that same thing. As far as the animal goes, the animal's going to be just as happy in that kind of situation. But, yeah, aquariums are just not – you know, some animals do great in aquariums, but they're just not really ideal for the animal.
Yes.
They're made for people, to look at them. But the animals, they just don't prefer to be looked at a whole ton in general. You know, most I can't think of a single reptile who prefers to be looked at. But ball pythons, especially, are more secretive than even other species are. So I think you have the best success if you do some kind of tub or rack system. These work best.
Okay. So I actually just received a message via direct message on Instagram. I'm not sure why you won't call in, but if you prefer to send me a direct message, a question, I will definitely ask the question on air. And this is from a guy named Justin also, and he asks, he has a ball python female that has just laid a clutch and he cannot get the eggs from the female. How is he able to get the eggs from the female?
Too defensive, or is that the question?
I'm guessing that the female. Yeah.
Okay, number one, this is the trick that's going to save you. Get a towel or a hand towel or a full size towel and just lay it over the top of the female. And then using the towel, or you can use a pillowcase or whatever, it's got a piece of cloth. Using that, you actually reach in and grab her using the towel and off her eggs. She won't, just having that towel over her is basically just going to stifle her urge to bite, and it's going to be no problem at all.
Okay. All right, so you heard that, Justin. Like you said, just put a towel over her, and that should be able to work out. So,
like a charm every time.
Oh, of course. So, take us back to your first time. Do you remember your first time pulling eggs from a female?
Yeah, I think so. I remember the first season, that's for sure. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, how did it go?
It's a little scary because you know ball pythons are super super chill, especially usually adult females because they've been around people for so many years by the time they're that size. But that just something snaps in their brain when it comes to protecting their eggs, and they do not apply all the they've learned for the last few years. When it comes to eggs, they forget all that and they go right back to their wild nature, which is kind of cool to see that you know instinct has such a strong effect on them that they can still be upset when you try to get those eggs away. You need to distract. You can distract them, and you know, and try to get your hands in there. A lot of them, they strike a lot, but they don't actually want to bite you. And if you just kind of put your hands in there and get it out, you know, she'll just pretend to bite, but won't actually. But I wouldn't say that always happens. I've got bit plenty of times pulling eggs.
No.
But the cloth trick takes care of that if you're nervous about it.
Okay. So. Speaking about eggs, what type of incubator do you use? Because on various posts on Instagram, your incubator seems like a full walk-in closet.
Right.
The size of my closet, it looks like. So what type of incubating methods do you use?
Right. So that in the past, I've used a lot of reclaimed refrigerators, you know, where I basically gutted them and put a heat element in there and a fan in a refrigerator. That works really, really well. I always still recommend that if you're handy at all to make your own little incubator out of a dead refrigerator. That works great. You know, you can get like the college size one, the half size one, if you don't have very many clutches. But when I moved to my new facility, I built the walk-in kind of closet type incubator, big glass door, so you can see what's going on in there. And, essentially, I'm just running. I have heat tape kind of along the ceiling. I like using that because it's low voltage. I have like 6 or 8 feet of heat tape literally screwed to the ceiling. And then that is just run by a good thermostat, which will, you know, just dial it up or dial it down. But the humidity and everything is actually controlled in the egg box. So I use vermiculite or perlite, whatever you're using, get that humidity right, seal up that egg box really airtight so it doesn't lose any moisture. And at that point, all you got to do is heat the room to the right temperature and you're set.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. No, whole room as an incubator. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And Justin actually sent us another reply. Justin, I'm pretty sure you should call in. The number is 713-955-0793, but I will of course honor your request. Now I'm gonna try to send it in text form, no texting language, so I'm going to try to decipher it and put it into terms that we can all understand, but basically it seems that he's asking, should you detach the eggs from each other?
No, if they have been for more than about 4 hours or so, at first they're really easy to pull apart in the first few hours after she's laid them. And if that's the case, then yeah, go ahead and pull them apart. No big deal. But if it's been more than four hours or so, and it sounds like it is, or she wouldn't be giving you a hard time getting her off them, then it's really pretty easy to tear the skin if you're not really experienced with it. So I would say leave them together and put them all in the egg boxes as one big lump.
All right. That's your answer, Justin. All right. So what are some tips that you have for aspiring ball python keepers? Not necessarily on the basis of breeding. We can get into that a little later. But just keeping some things that are must-haves or some supplies that you recommend or anything along those lines.
I think it's good to don't skimp on your equipment. That's the number one thing. I mean, a lot of people will put a $1,000 ball python, you know, if they've invested in or bought an expensive ball python, they'll put a $1,000 ball python in a little tub, that they got from Walmart, and they'll put an under tank heater in there, and they'll run the whole thing on a, you know, $20 Petco thermostat. What you have there is a big investment in an animal that you want to see, you know, you enjoy for many years, but you've put that entire investment in the hands of a $20 thermostat, which is not going to last. It may never do. So I would just say it's going to be a little bit painful up front, but, you know, invest in a decent rack system if you can afford it, maybe a couple $100, you know, a really good thermostat that will always work and will never fail, you know, and kill your snake will be, you know, about $100-$120 or so. And then you can fill your rack, you know, with snakes as you grow and as you want to, but you always know that you're not going to come home to a fire or a bunch of dead animals or
yes.
something because you relied on sloppy equipment. That's probably the number one thing.
Yeah. So, in regards to breeding, what are some tips that you have for aspiring breeders?
I would say that they're fairly easy. Ball pythons are. I remember when I was a kid, I had a friend who had two ball pythons that he kept in the same aquarium. It was a really bad situation. But every year, the female would lay a bunch of eggs, and he would just take them down to the pet store and give them to the guy who owned the pet store every year. And he had no idea what he was doing with them, but, you know, they're fairly easy, I would say. The trick is just really to keep them healthy, get them to good breeding weight, and introduce them to each other and let nature take its course. There's a lot of little fancy tricks you can do with temperatures and all that. That'll probably give you better results if you're doing it on a large, you know, kind of professional scale. But for the average person, I think you just pretty much put them together and you'll get fairly good results most of the time. I think most people try to keep their ball pythons a little warmer than they need to be too. I would say that maybe run them a little cooler than most of the care sheets out there recommend.
Okay, so a lot of people look at ball pythons as a great starter animal, but they also look at corn snakes as a great starter animal also. So I'm not sure if you have any background or any history keeping corn snakes, but
I've had a couple corn snakes. Yeah. I would say the big difference between as far as a starter animal. So pros and cons, a corn snake is super cheap, relatively speaking, and you can get some cool stuff
that's
relatively expensive or free. Yeah.
Yes.
But they're going to be good feeders. That's another big upside to them. Downside to them is they can be a little bit more difficult to deal with when they're feeding because they can kind of go into feeding mode and they'll bite anything that moves. They get fairly long, and they're just never going to be as chill as a ball python, which some people prefer that. Some people want it to be moving constantly when they're holding it. But that's what they're going to do. They're going to move, and you're going to be kind of chasing them around with your hands, trying to keep them close to you. For ball python, a lot of times you'll just set them on your lap, and they'll stay there for 3 hours. That's just, you know, that's kind of the difference between them as far as personality goes. Ball pythons are going to be a little bit more finicky when it comes to eating, and they're going to be a little bit more pricey for some of the really cool morphs out there.
Yeah. So
I think that's probably the biggest difference between them.
Of course. So if you do have a ball python that it's not eating, how do you recommend going about it? I mean, when I got my first ball python, probably about a good 5 years back from the New York Reptile Expo, she did not eat for about a good 3 months. I mean, no, 3 weeks, sorry. Why did I say months?
Okay.
3 weeks. 3 weeks. So I know how it feels to have an animal. You're doing everything right, but it still does not continue to eat. So and even when she was well established, well into her adult life, she would go spells, just don't eat. So what do you recommend?
I think if you first thing I recommend is getting a degree in psychology. because I think that's the biggest problem sometimes. Like, there a lot of times there seems to be absolutely no physical reason, you know, and you can do this and that and this and that. You sure all the care is perfect and they still won't eat. You know, I've had probably the longest feeding break I've had with 13 months. And the snake was actually healthy the whole time. I mean, it never lost a significant amount of weight. It's still alive and good today. But I think the main thing is, I actually think it's psychological. If your care is correct, then I think psychologically there is an aspect to it. And one of the things I think people do a lot is their snake will go off feed and they'll offer their snake feed every week, sometimes twice or three times a week, because they want it to eat so bad. They get nervous. You know, people have a hard time accepting when an animal doesn't eat because it's so weird to us. You know, we eat three times a day. Some of us more. And
certainly
it's
me.
It's so hard for us to understand why a snake would not eat for 3 weeks, right? Or 3 months even. It seems like you're killing an animal. So usually, a lot of times in that situation, people will freak out and start offering it meals more and more and more often in desperation. And I think what that does actually is what you're doing is you're creating a really deeply ingrained habit of refusal. Okay? Mm. Because For example, if you offer it once a week, it's going to refuse 12 times in 3 months. Okay. If you offer it, that's 12 times it's refused in a row. That's a pretty deep habit being built. Okay. If you offer it three times a week, then you're talking about 36 refusals in 3 months. That's a much deeper habit. So for me, when I have an animal go off feed, I'll offer it feed, you know, pretty much once every few weeks. You know, and as soon as it starts eating again, then I'll feed it every week again. But there's no reason to just sit there and like try to just keep trying over and over and over and over. You know, whatever it is about that snake that doesn't want to eat, it's not going to change, you know, overnight or even in a week necessarily. So that's one thing. And the other thing is just change of environment. I have a big article I wrote about ball python feeding habits. And that is that it's partly goes into the whole habitual thing as well. But sometimes you just take a ball python in a perfect situation and you just move it somewhere else, even if it's a worse situation. There's a tub that's too small for it or a tub that's too big for it. Something else. Just try something else, you know. And sometimes just that aspect of taking it out of the environment that it's been in for a long time, moving to an environment that it's not used to, will break that chain of habit that it's worked on, that's built, and it'll think, everything's changed, and it won't have the habit of refusing in the new situation. And I think that is probably the number one thing to try if your snake is refusing over and over and your care conditions are good.
Yeah, okay. That was some great advice right there. So some people, in regards to feeding, some people are pro this and some people are con this, and that is putting calcium on the rodents like you would dust the insects with. So do you do that with your snakes, or do you advise for it or advise against it?
I've never heard of anybody successful in this business that does that with ball pythons at least. I know their environment is definitely not as varied in our you know, here in the US or whatever in captivity as it would be in the wild, but I've just never really seen a problem. One of the main things we would notice if they had calcium deficiencies would be in the eggs. But we just find consistently, it doesn't matter if it's a 20-year-old female or a 3-year-old female, their eggshells are always the same. They always seem to have plenty of thing when it comes to make that. You'd be worried if a snake, you know, after being bred for 10 years, had thinner eggshells or something like that, which shows it's maybe building up a deficiency. But I just don't think it's, I don't think we've seen anything to make that necessary in ball pythons, at least.
Yeah, okay. So let's just do a real little recap. If you mind recapping for us some of the tips that you want our listeners to go away with tonight in regards to keeping the ball pythons specifically.
Sure, yeah. So invest in your caging as much as the animal, you know, because one's dependent on the other. Do your research. Don't be afraid to try new things. Don't be afraid to break the mold a little bit. feed live if live doesn't bother you. I think the animals prefer it. What else have we covered here? I don't know. Maybe, yeah, have some fun with it, and don't be afraid to ask questions if you get stumped on something.
Yeah. So where can our listeners find you at on the daily and catch up on what you're working with, or possibly invest in one of your beautiful animals?
Sure. So my name is Justin Kobelka, and most people can't spell that after hearing it before you even say it. Justin Kobelka. But if you just type in Justin Ball Python, I'll be your first, you know, search result on Google. So you'll find me there, or JKR, Jacob Belker Reptiles is the name of the business. You can find me on Instagram, the same search, you know, on Facebook, or I'm pretty much everywhere anyone wants to be these days on the socials. And pretty easy to connect to, and you can see what's going on here. And I also have a great blog and YouTube. My YouTube channel is, I think, probably the third most watched reptile YouTube channel that I know of. And so you find me on YouTube and find me on my blog and, yeah, follow along.
Yeah. And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't mind taking a look down there in your player, that is the little place where you click the play button to start the stream tonight. There are a few pictures of some of the animals Justin has produced, as well as the world famous now emoji ball python that will be going to a new owner soon. But yeah, some of the animals that he has produced are right there, so you can take a look and just follow all the links that he said, and you guys will be connected. I thank you so much, Justin, for coming on tonight. We really did enjoy chatting with you.
Great, my pleasure. I hope everybody learned something, and I appreciate you bringing me on as well.
All right, thank you. We will be talking to you very soon.
All right, you have a great evening.
You too. Ah, good. All right, so that does it for us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I thank you guys so much for listening in. Like I said, next week we will not be having a show because I will be going on a trip. And if you would like to see more on those on that trip details, you can find us on Instagram at ESRLive. And we will be updating you guys through there, as well as our text message reminder. Subscribers have just received their first giveaway 2 days ago, so why don't you join into the fun? It is a great way to be able to see what's going on in ESR Live, as well as be the first people to know about new shows, as well as any show cancellations or any changes of schedule. How you can enter this show message reminder text thing is you can text at show Remy to 81010. That is at show Remy to 81010. And you will be connected right there, and we'll be able to chit chat through there, and we will have a lot of fun, as well as some giveaways will be hosted just for those subscribers. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a little tired tonight, so I'm going to be logging off. So I thank you guys so much for listening in, and I will see you guys back here, not next week, but the following week, which will be the first week of June, and we're getting into our summer series. So more information will be announced about what we're going to be doing over the summer very shortly. Once again, I thank you guys so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and I thank Justin once again, and we will be talking to you guys very, very soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Empire State Reptiles Live. Find us online at EmpireStateReptilesLive.com.